Genesis chapter 5. There's four main events that take place in the beginning part of the book of Genesis. There is the creation of the heavens and the earth and all that is in them. There is the fall of man in chapter 3, and then the flood of Noah's day in chapters 6 through 9. The Bible gives testimony to the historical fact of Noah and the flood throughout the Bible. Noah is mentioned in the book of Isaiah, the book of Ezekiel, 1 Chronicles, Matthew, Luke, 1 and 2 Peter, and the book of Hebrews. And so rather than Noah being just this fictitious person that's a myth is built around in the Old Testament, we have this testimony throughout the scriptures of the fact that he was a real man. And especially when you get to the New Testament, it's specifically mentioning not just Noah, but also the flood that took place at that time as well. Jesus said in Luke chapter 17, beginning from verse 26, "And as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be also in the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all." As it was in the days of Noah, what we're going to be seeing as we go through some of these passages is that the earth was corrupt in those days, and that's the reason that the flood came upon the earth. But do you notice in these verses how Jesus not only mentions Noah as a historical person, but also the ark and also the flood that came and destroyed them all, speaking of a flood that was not simply local, but a flood that was global across the entire earth. In fact, what's interesting is that archaeologists say many civilizations have flood stories that are very similar to the account in Genesis. In fact, there's over 200 cultures that have their own account of the flood with very similar aspects in them. And that, to me, it just testifies to the fact that there was something that actually took place, because this is spread around the world to, again, over 200 cultures. And the things that they have in common, 88% describe a favored family of these flood stories. 70% of these stories attribute survival to a boat. 95% say the sole cause of the catastrophe is a flood. 66% say that the disaster is due to man's wickedness. 67% record that animals are also saved. And 57% describe that the survivors end up on a mountain. In fact, many of the counts also specifically mention birds being sent out, a rainbow, and 8 persons being saved. And so to me, that's just kind of a testimony that you see. And they're tweaked. All of them are a little tweaked, but they have these things here in common. To me, it testifies that an event actually took place. And I believe we have the historical accurate story here in the book of Genesis of what actually took place at that time. The purpose for the flood was to judge man for his sin and, if you will, wash away the corruption that has filled the earth. The Bible Knowledge Commentary says sin had infected every aspect of life, and nothing short of a new beginning would suffice. So as we're heading to these chapters on the flood, we left off last week looking at the first family, Cain and Abel, looking at the first murder, Cain murdering his brother Abel. And then as we come to chapter 5, it's a chapter that's dedicated to simply the genealogical tie from Adam to Noah. As I mentioned last week, many of the genealogies, the purpose for them is not to have an account of everybody who ever lived. It's simply to follow that line of the promise that was given in the garden, that the seed of the woman would come and bruise or crush the seed of the serpent, or the head of the serpent. In other words, the seed of the woman, the Messiah coming, the Lord Jesus Christ, and putting an end to what Satan had begun there in the Garden of Eden. So in Genesis chapter 5, we have from Adam going all the way down to Noah. And the interesting thing that we see is in Genesis chapter 5 is that men lived over 900 years. And so these guys had long, long lives. And the question comes up as to how could they possibly live so long, or why did they live so long back then, and why do we not live that long right now? And I think there's a couple reasons. And of course, this is speculation, but there are a number of people who suggest that there was a water canopy, a vapor canopy that was around the earth. And in the book of Genesis, chapter 1, when we were looking at the creation days, there was a time where God created this great expanse that separated the waters that were above the expanse from the waters that were below. In other words, the waters that were above this vapor canopy from the waters that were below, which would later be the oceans and the seas. And so it's believed, again, this is speculation, but it's believed that the vapor canopy shielded man upon the earth from the ultraviolet rays that would come and make him susceptible to more disease and thus a shorter life that would take place. But be that as it may, the average age before the flood was 912 years as we look at Genesis chapter 5. That's pretty old, all right? You can get a lot done in 900 years, couldn't you? And especially if these are 900 quality years, which is what they were. It wasn't like, you know, they hit 80 or 90 and then they're just these old decrepit things for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years. But these are healthy men and women that are on the earth for that long. It's pretty amazing, isn't it, when you think about how life, the quality of life and the things that could be accomplished would be advanced in that kind of a time frame that you would have. And so as you look at Genesis chapter 5, the way the genealogy works is, like Adam as an example, when he was 130 years old, he had Seth, who would be in the line to Noah. And then it says he lived another 800 years, so a total of 930 years. And so that's the way the ages are broken down in the passage in Genesis chapter 5. After the flood, on the other hand, we see that the average age dropped significantly. And so you do have Noah, who was 600 years when the flood hit, who lived to be quite an old person. But after that, it dramatically shifts until you get all the way down to Joseph, who is the great-grandson of Abraham, and he lived to be 110 years old. And the Bible tells us that we live 70 years. And if we get another 10 years, it's bonus time, you know. And that's about what we see. About 70 years old, 80 years old is about how long man lives. And so what happened to dramatically cause the lifespan to shrink? Many people think it was the pouring forth of the vapor canopy that was around the earth at the time of Noah's flood, the depletion of that to flood the earth. And then, of course, the different effects that the sun's rays would have. And of course, as time would go on, the different mutations that would form and how we would pass down diseases from generation to generation and so forth. And so again, speculation, but taking a look at the obvious here, long life and then a much shorter life. It's also interesting to see when these people live so long that Adam was alive at the same time as Noah's father. We tend to think, as we're looking at thousands of years, when you take Adam coming all the way down to Abraham and later Moses, that these people were so far removed. But check out how this works. Adam would have still been alive at the same time as Noah's father, and Noah would have been alive at the same time as Abraham. That's interesting, isn't it? So you've got Noah potentially sitting down with Abraham, being able to tell him this is what it was like before the flood, this is what life was like on earth, and this is what it was like during the flood. And so that's pretty remarkable. In fact, if you put this together, Jacob, the grandson of Abraham, could have received third hand what happened in the Garden of Eden. And that's just amazing to think about that when you think of the word of mouth communicating on down the line, that many generations, just third hand what took place in the Garden of Eden. So anyway, that's Genesis chapter 5. That brings us to the birth of Noah, and that's where I wanted to take it up today in Genesis chapter 5, verse 28, which says of Noah's father, Lamech lived 182 years, verse 28, and had a son. And he called his name Noah, saying, this one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed. Genesis 5:30. After he begot Noah, Lamech lived 595 years and had sons and daughters. So all the days of Lamech, and this is kind of cool, were 777 years, and he died. And Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begot Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So we have the birth of Noah and his sons as we segue right into Genesis chapter 6. Now it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man, whom I've created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. So as we look at chapter 6 here, the main thing that we want to take away is what the earth was like at this time and why the flood came. It's because man's heart was totally wicked, and it was throughout the entire earth. You know, every thought of their heart, evil continually. And this is the reason that we see in chapter 6. I do want to comment, though, in chapter 6, because chapter 6 is a chapter that's been debated quite hotly because of the topic that's in it. As far as the interpretation as to what exactly is going on here in the details, who are the sons of God that were taking the daughters of men, having children with them, and seemingly coming away with this race of giants, the mighty men on the earth, the men of renown? And there's a few different interpretations. One of them is that the sons of God are simply referring to the line of Seth, Adam, Seth, this godly line that were intermarrying with the daughters of men being the women that were descendants of Cain, the murderer. And so you have the godly marrying the wicked and wickedness just spreading throughout the earth. And, you know, the unequally yoked aspect of it. And that is how people interpret this passage. It doesn't address why just the descendants of Seth would be godly and all of the women from Cain's line would be wicked. And it doesn't really address why you have these giants that are on the earth as well. Another interpretation is that the sons of God aren't men, but they're actually angels. They're fallen angels, or they're demons, and they're cohabiting with earthly women, and the product of that are these giants that are upon the earth, and of course the wickedness from Satan that is now infiltrated into the human race and spread throughout the human race, and that being the reason why God is putting an end to it at that point and starting over with Noah. Now, I know saying that, it sounds like Greek mythology, a demigod type of a thing, or science fiction, if you will. A couple of things that support that view is that the three other times that the phrase sons of God is used in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew, it's always referring to angels. Added on top of that is this is the way that the ancient rabbis interpreted Genesis chapter 6. It's the way that the early church interpreted it. And from my understanding, it is the interpretation that the Septuagint translators gave to the passage when they were translating the Old Testament Hebrew into Greek, which would have been the Bible of Jesus and the apostles. So that becomes really interesting, doesn't it? So you can see where having these two interpretations would be quite different. There's a third interpretation that I want to throw out here, and I'll tell you, I think I'm leaning more towards the third at this point in my Christian life, and I think that is that these sons of God, these men, were actually human beings that were not just influenced, but possessed by demons, because we do see demon possession in the scriptures and the wickedness where men, and I think this is the idea, not that men are trying to be godly and they're possessed by demons, but these men have become so wicked that they're embracing demonism. They're embracing spirits coming and possessing them. They're totally turning away from God's law. It's no longer just one man and one woman for marriage, but I'm going to take whatever woman I want, and corruption is just now completely spread across the human race. Admittedly, it doesn't really address the question as to seemingly why there is this race of Nephilim or giants that are upon the earth at this time, but it seems to make a little bit more sense, possibly. The reason people reject the sons of God being angels is because of what Jesus said in the Gospel of Matthew, that in heaven, we're going to not marry, but we're going to be like the angels. And so some people interpret that as angels being sexless. It doesn't say that, but some people interpret it that way. So I at least wanted to give you those options. That's not the main fact of what's happening here in Genesis chapter 6. I don't want to lose the forest because of the trees or whatever that saying means. You know what I'm saying? I want to make sure we focus in on the main details, and that is the reality that it's clear that these verses show the wickedness of the human race and that death was its ongoing punishment. Don't you love verse 8? The buts of scripture, but Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. That's what's sweet about it. Noah, as we've been tracking the hall of faith, there was Enoch, and then there was Abel, there was Enoch, and then Noah in the hall of faith in Hebrews chapter 11. Where it says, by faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness, which is according to faith. So Noah was a man of faith. It's going to tell us that he walked with God, and he found grace in God's eyes. Peter says of Noah in 2 Peter 2:5, that God did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly. So this long period of time that Noah was building the ark, he was preaching. And he was telling the people, even though it hadn't rained on the earth yet, he was telling them that there was going to be a great flood and that they needed to come to God. They needed to come to the ark and get their life right with God. But the only people who enter the ark are Noah and his wife and his sons and their wives. And it's kind of sad to see that many people passed on the invitation to come. What is neat to see, though, is that Noah's children responded to that. And that's what kind of spoke to my heart this week, is that, you know, we don't want to sacrifice our children on the altar of ministry. You know what I mean by that? It doesn't mean just being a pastor, but for the sake of the ministry. We don't want to be trying to reach out to all these other people and let our kids slip through the cracks. I feel like if myself as a parent, if I neglect my kids for the sake of the ministry, then I've really failed as a parent. And that's something that can't happen. It can't happen really in any of our households. Our kids are our number one ministry, is we want to share the love of Jesus with them. We want to model who Jesus is and what it means to have a relationship with him. And we don't want to lose them because we're the ones that can have the greatest influence in our kids' lives. Don't misunderstand. I recognize that it's a personal choice that everyone makes, but we can have a great impact on our kids, can't we, in how we live and model what it means to live for Jesus. So we see the corruption that's on the earth, and then we see Noah now building the ark. Verse 9, it says, this is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations, and the idea is he was a man of integrity. He was an upright man. Noah walked with God. And Noah begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Verse 14, make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark. The word for rooms literally means compartments or nests, if you will, in the ark. And cover it inside and outside with pitch. The idea would be to waterproof the ark. And this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. A cubit is a foot and a half, so we're talking about a 450-foot long boat. Verse 16, you shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it to a cubit from above and set the door of the ark in its side. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. So think about a cruise ship that has multiple decks. And behold, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh in which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. This is the first time the word covenant is used in the Bible. The details of that covenant, that relationship, will be given in chapter 9. Verse 19, and of every living thing of all flesh you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, of animals after their kind, and of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind, two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. And you shall take for yourself of all food that is eaten, and you shall gather it to yourself, and it shall be food for you and for them. Thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him, so he did. So we have the building of the ark here. He was to take a pair of all the animals that God would bring him, and food, and he would stay in the ark. Now, one of the things I wanted to point out is in verse 14, where God is telling Noah to make an ark of gopher wood, and that he's to cover it inside and outside with pitch. And I think the practical idea of that is so that it would be waterproof, as he's building it of wood and then covering it with this tar type of material. What's really cool that's lying in the original language is that the Hebrew word for pitch is the word kofar, and it's the noun form of the root verb kofar, which means to cover, and that word is translated virtually every time in the Old Testament as atonement. It's used in Leviticus chapter 17, verse 11, where it says, "For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement for the soul." It is the blood that causes your sin to be covered over as if it never happened. And so it's interesting to see, and this, let me quote Henry Morris from the Genesis record, his commentary on Genesis, because I think he says it so nicely. He says, most likely this pitch is a resinous material that would, quote, keep out the waters of judgment, just as the blood of the Lamb provides a perfect atonement for the soul. It's pretty cool, isn't it? Again, underlying there in the Hebrew text that's before us. So depending on the size you use for a cubit, it's roughly 18 inches, but depending on the size, the ark was anywhere from 450 feet to 515 feet long, roughly 75 feet wide and 45 feet tall. Compared to the Titanic, it was a little over half the size, but still a really big boat nonetheless. You could put three space shuttles end to end, and the ark was still bigger. The design, and I read this from a number of people, was ideal for stability and capacity. In other words, it was a very seaworthy vessel when you simply even just read the dimensions of the ark. It would have the capacity of 522 livestock railroad cars. So if you think of all of the animals he's going to put in there, picture a train that has 522 livestock cars on it. That's a train that's over 6 miles long. Could be filled up and take those and put them inside of the ark. It would be able to fit 125,000 sheep. They say that there's no more than 25,000 species of animals that are alive or extinct. The average size of all animals is less than that of a sheep. And all the animals, in conclusion, could have been stored in less than half the capacity of Noah's ark, each pair in their appropriate room, or verse 14 again, literally, their appropriate nest. And Noah most likely would have taken babies rather than the full-grown elephants and so forth, two of each kind, two dogs, etc., not two of each type, not two greyhounds, two yellow labs, two chihuahuas, but just two dogs. And they would take care of the rest as time went on, and you'd have the different types of animals. And I don't know if I emphasized it or not, but the end of verse 20, God said that two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. Noah didn't have to go out and try and round up all these animals. There was a migration, if you will, that God put into them to draw these animals to safety. And that's just kind of fascinating anyway, isn't it? How God has designed animals to have that ability to migrate to a place of safety, like we see animals migrating today. The other thing that is speculation, but is worth noting, is that it's likely that most of these animals hibernated while they were on the ark. Rather than thinking of all of these animals running around and attacking one another, again, God has designed animals to be able to do that, where you've got their bodily functions not shutting down, but getting pretty close to where they're sleeping, they don't need to eat, the whole issue of the bathroom and stuff like that. And so it's speculation, but something to think about as you're wondering, how did all this take place? And so here the ark is built, and now as we look at chapter 7, Noah enters the ark. It says, "Then the Lord said to Noah, 'Come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation.'" Here's the invitation here in chapter 7, verse 1. Come on in. Come on in and be spared the waters of judgment. That's the message that God gave to Noah. It's the message that I believe Noah was probably preaching, as Peter said, he was a preacher of righteousness. And it's a message that continues to go out today, to come to God for safety. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 11, verse 28, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." So often it's when a person is at the end of themselves that they finally respond to that invitation. My life is in turmoil. I'm totally filled with anxiety. And Jesus is offering me not only a new start, but he's offering me peace. And so often people respond to that, which we should respond to that, because he is the only one that can provide us with that refuge. The very end of the Bible, Revelation 22, it says, "The Spirit and the bride say, 'Come.' And let him who hears say, 'Come.' And let him who thirsts, 'Come.' Whoever desires, let him take the water of life freely." So come and avert the waters of judgment that are going to come upon the earth. Come and avert the judgment that's going to fall, that every man will stand before God one day, so that that judgment can be bypassed in your life. And so the invitation to come. The sad thing, again, is that you only see Noah and his kids. There's only a total of 8 people. But that's what Jesus said as well, that the road is narrow that leads to life, and there are few that find it. Broad is the way that leads to destruction. And so if you find yourself in the minority as a Christian, it's simply the way it's been, and it's the way Jesus said it would be as well, that not everybody's going to go, "Oh, yeah, that's what I want." You're going to be in the minority. And it's a sad thing. And I think it grieves not only our hearts, but definitely the heart of God, that people aren't responding to his invitation to come and to be spared the judgment that would fall. And so the bid to Noah and his family to come into the ark. Verse 2 of chapter 7, "You shall take with you 7 each of every clean animal, a male and his female, 2 each of animals that are unclean, a male and his female. Also 7 each of birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of all the earth. For after 7 more days, I will cause it to rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will destroy from the face of the earth all living things that I have made." And Noah did, according to all that the Lord commanded him. Noah was 600 years old when the floodwaters were on the earth. And so as we look at the details here, he was to take 2 of every kind, male and female, to keep them alive. But of the clean animals, he was to take 7. And the reason for that, I think we see in chapters 8 and 9. In chapter 8, verse 20, it tells us that they would be for burnt offerings. Genesis 8:20 says, "Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar," a sacrifice to God. So if you'd only taken 2, you could see there'd be a problem. You know, you offer one of them, that's the end of that line, you know. So he's to take 7 for burnt offerings. And also chapter 9, look at this, chapter 9, verse 3, God told Noah, "Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as the green herbs." In the beginning, vegetarian. After the flood, they can eat meat. And so the clean animals would be the animals they would eat. Now, my question is, how did he know what was clean and what was unclean? You ever think about that? I mean, we don't get the list of what's clean and unclean until we get to the days of Moses. And he's the one who codifies the law. He's the one who wrote down the law that God gave him. The only answer to this is that God was communicating to these people about animal sacrifice. He was communicating about what is clean and what is unclean. And it's just in the days of Moses that these things are written down. It's interesting to think about that, isn't it? But again, we are filling in blanks with speculation, but I think pretty good speculation as we look at that. So now we look at the floodwaters coming, verse 7. So Noah with his sons, his wife and his sons' wives went into the ark because of the waters of the flood. Of clean animals, of animals that are unclean, of birds, and of everything that creeps on the earth. Two by two, they went into the ark to Noah, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. And it came to pass after 7 days that the waters of the flood were on the earth. Verse 11, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. And the rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. So notice it's not just raining. It's the fountains of the great deep that are broken up. These are the subterranean caverns where water is. Whether it's plate tectonics, whatever's happening, you have got water now rushing out from the ground, and you have this water canopy that's over the earth flooding down upon the earth for 40 days. We know what waters do when it's raining for just a handful of days. We know what kind of flooding can take place. It's interesting, isn't it, that we're having this study at this time. Think about it raining for 40 days, and we're talking a water canopy. We're not talking simply clouds that have picked up water from the ocean, but we're talking all over the earth, water pouring down and these subterranean caverns opening up and coming out and flooding the earth. So this was just a global deluge that would come upon the earth at this time. It says in verse 13, on the very same day, and Noah and Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah's wife, and the three wives of his sons with them entered the ark. They and every beast after its kind, all cattle after their kind, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth after its kind, and every bird after its kind, every bird of every sort. And they went into the ark to Noah, two by two, of all flesh, in which is the breath of life. So those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. The Lord is the one who called him, and the Lord is the one who sealed the door, if you will, to protect them inside of this. As the floodwaters of judgment come on the earth to literally wash the earth of all of the evil that's there, God is the one who has provided this way of salvation, and he is the one who is protecting them during this time. In Psalm 91, verses 1 and 2, it says, he who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God. In him I will trust. Amen. He's the one that bids us to come to be saved, and he's the one that will keep us all the way to the end. He who has begun a good work in you will bring it to completion under the day of Jesus Christ. So often we think, and we know that we miss the mark so bad as Christians, we think, am I even going to make it? God is the one who has called you, and he is the one who will keep you. Do you believe that? Yes. You need to, because it's true. Don't let your feelings dictate. Let the facts dictate that he is the one that will be able to present you before him blameless, and we can rejoice in that day. And so now we look at the flood, and we're just going to end with chapter 7, but let's go ahead and finish off chapter 7 as we see the flood waters coming upon the earth. Now the flood was on the earth 40 days. The waters increased and lifted up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed and greatly increased on the earth, and the ark moved about on the surface of the waters. And the waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. Sounds global, doesn't it? It doesn't sound like regional flood here. It does. The terminology is global. So they prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. Verse 20, the waters prevailed 15 cubits upward, and the mountains were covered. So 15 cubits, 22 and a half feet above the tallest mountain peak, now filled with water. And all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds and cattle and beasts and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, and every man, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, all that was on the dry land died. So he destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground, both man and cattle, creeping thing and bird of the air. They were destroyed from the earth. Only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive. And the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. So it rained for 40 days, and the waters prevailed, stayed upon the earth for 150 days. Now, if this were a global flood, it would totally wipe out everything that's on the face of the earth, obviously except for the fish, okay? Fish are in the water, they're probably going to be okay. But everything that has within it the breath of life, the animals, man, even the birds, would need safety, and that's why they're called into the ark. Now, if this were not a global flood, then the ark itself, don't you love that picture? If this was just a local flood here, and it's flooding over the tops of the mountains here, really the ark was unnecessary, wasn't it? I mean, couldn't you just go beyond where the flooding's going to take place? Couldn't we just have all the animals migrate out of the flood zone? So the ark really would have been unnecessary if it were a local flood. Also, if this were only a local flood, then God's promise to never again bring such a flood would be false, because we've had a lot of flooding upon the earth. God's promise that we're going to see next time we're together is that he's not going to destroy the earth this way again. So all of the flooding that's taking place, we go, God, I thought you weren't going to flood like this anymore. Well, he's not going to flood like this anymore. He's not going to flood the entire earth. And so if this were just local, then God's promise would be false. And also, if this were only a local flood, the Bible would be wrong when it traces all of humanity back to Noah and his sons, and the passages that speak of a universal flood, such as Psalm 104. Would be false as well. Now, one thing to note that I find interesting is that most of the mountain ranges are made up of massive flood deposited layers. Fossils abound on the tops of the highest mountains. I remember, and it's not a high mountain, but going out to Fish Creek and seeing the marine fossils that are out there. The top 3,000 feet of Mount Everest, from 26,000 to 29,000, is made up of sedimentary rock packed with seashells and other ocean-dwelling animals. Even the summit of Mount Ararat, which is where the ark is going to rest, was at one time underwater, evidenced by the marine fossils that have been found there. And of course, the question is, how did those fossils get there? How did these marine fossils get on the tops of the mountains? And I think the answer to that is that they were flooded. You know, they were covered underwater at one point. And this is where we wrestle with it a little bit. We're going, are you telling me that the earth was flooded so bad that the water was 29,000 feet above the ground level? And the answer to that is most likely the mountains were not that tall, that the mountains rose after the flood waters receded. Psalm 104, and admittedly, this psalm could be taken as a creation psalm, or it could be taken as a psalm that deals with the flood. You can see it differently in different translations. But Psalm 104 says, the waters were standing above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. At the sound of your thunder, they hurried away. The mountains rose. The valleys sank down to the place which you established for them. You got the earth covered in water. All that water receded to some place. So it's going to go down into these subterranean caverns, and you've got this mushy earth at this point with waters receding. And this is the theory, is that mountains were springing up as the waters are receding into the ground. So we have the mountain ranges that we have today because of the flood. There's enough water in the oceans right now to cover the earth if the surface of the earth were smooth to cover the earth 8,000 feet deep right now with the waters that are on the earth. And so that's what you would do as far as speculating about that. And I find it fascinating, but if you have other questions, because this is the biggie, really, is it not? The idea of creation versus evolution. Have we been here for millions of years? Have we evolved to this point? The creationist argument, especially the young earth creationist, is the flood is the answer to the majority of these questions, that there was a global flood, and that's why we have the fossils that we have. That's why we have the lens that we look through to see a young earth that was created is based all around the flood. I'm not an expert in this. I really find it fascinating. But we have somebody who I would call an expert that's going to be here in 2 weeks. And so if you have questions, this is the guy you want to ask. Bill Morgan, who's coming, who's a creation apologist, is very intelligent when it comes to specifically the basis for young earth creationism, and that is the flood of Noah's day. So break out your pencil, jot those things down. You can ask me. I'll probably tell you hang on for 2 weeks, and we'll see what Bill has to say, okay? So bottom line here, as we take a look at this, is the people are corrupt. God would wash away the evil with the flood. Jesus, when he was asked as to his return at his second coming, he said this in Matthew 24, beginning from verse 37. But as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage. Now, we read that now, and it looks a little bit different, doesn't it? As we're looking at the sons of God going to the daughters of men and taking every woman they want to. It's not just, oh, they're marrying like, you know, we always have married. No, it's the corruption that is on the earth and not going about things the way the Lord had laid them down. So they're going to be doing that until the day that Noah entered the ark and did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So also will the coming of the Son of Man be. In other words, the conditions of the world before the coming of Jesus will be like the conditions of the world before the flood, where every intent of the thought of man was only evil continually. And personally, I don't think we're that far off from it. But think about what's going to take place when Jesus returns. What happened here? All of the ungodly perished in the flood, and it was just the righteous that were on the earth, Noah and his family, that were populating the earth at that time. What's going to happen when Jesus returns at his second coming? He's going to have people before him, and he's going to divide them as a shepherd would divide the sheep from the goats. You remember that passage in Matthew chapter 25, where the sheep are going to be able to come in, the believers are going to be able to come in to inherit the kingdom on the earth, and the unbelievers, they're going to be the ones that will go to eternal punishment. So it's a very similar thing that's going to take place at the return of Jesus. And so what's it going to be like when you return? Well, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be in the days of the Son of Man when he returns. So the bottom line with this section is that we want to make sure that we heed God's invitation to come to him, to, as it was in Noah's day, come to the ark as it is in our day, is to come to Jesus so that our sin can be forgiven. That's what keeps us out of God's presence, is sin in our life. And even though we're not perfect, once we become Christians, our sin is still forgiven. And that's what makes a Christian different than a non-Christian, is you've been forgiven of your past sin, of your present sin, and your future sin. It's unfortunate that we do sin, but it's because we still live in these corrupt bodies. It's not an excuse to live in sin, but that's going to happen. So when you feel like you're a failure, recognize that God knows that there's going to be those struggles that we have in our life. But he's died. He's given his son for you, your past, your present, and your future sin. That's what makes you different. And that's what's going to allow you to be able to go into his presence when you leave this earth.